Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Hi, this is Deborah Yao. I'm the editor of AI Business, and I'm here to welcome a special guest, the renowned AI expert Luke Julia. He is currently the chief scientific officer at Reno, and he's also known as the co-creator of Siri. He is the best-selling author of There's No Such Thing as Artificial Intelligence, and his most recent book is called On Va Droit dans le Mur, or Are We Headed for Disaster, if that's the correct translation. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
So I seem to sense a skeptical theme here in your book titles about AI. So let's take your most recent book. Are we headed for disaster?
Yeah, what I was going to try to explain, you know, in this book is that technology is not good just for the sake of technology. And we need to be very careful, you know, when we are creating stuff and doing, you know, using those technologies, in particular AI, because this is, you know, what I'm doing for the past 30 years. We need to be very careful at understanding the impact, right? Because, you know, every time we are using AI and we are creating those models that are using a lot of data, we're using data centers and stuff like that. I mean, it's a lot of resources that we are using. So we need to understand if we really need them and why we are doing that, right? Because, I mean, there is a fact, and this is what, you know, the book is saying, you know, basically in the title. The fact is that for the past 120 years or something, we are having, you know, we are using more and more technology, but we are also creating more and more CO2, and you know, we are destroying the planet basically. So, so we need to be conscious about it. We need to realize that that we have an impact, a big impact, you know, that our use of the technology is part of it. I mean, the reality is that digital today, you know, in terms of impact and CO2 creation, is more than planes, you know. So, I mean, it means something. So what I'm trying to explain is, you know, look at what you are doing, understand your impact. You know, when you take a selfie, it's actually not, you know, something that doesn't have any impact. It is something that takes energy. You know, a selfie is about 180 watts if you share it. So 180 watts, if there are, you know, 1 billion selfies taken every day, it's basically 180 megawatts, you know, that are taken every day just for selfies, just for ego. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, we need to understand, and then we make the right decision. But we shouldn't spit on technology, and we should understand that technology is also good potentially to help us to not to go into the war, you know, and to save the planet maybe. So that's a balance. But before, you know, taking any decisions, we need to educate ourselves about the impact that we have and that we had. Have, you know, in the past 120 years.
So if you can assess the tech industry today in terms of sustainability and responsibility, where does it stand?
So, I mean, it's not very good. So, I mean, this is the issue. This is why, you know, I'm basically, you know, raising the flag because the it's easy. I mean, technology is easy. We made everything, you know, easy to do. And so everybody can actually do AI today. Everybody can, you know, do something with AI today. And we don't realize that what we are doing, it has some impact, you know, very far from us in those data centers. We don't see them. You know, they are far from us, so we don't see them. That's fine. And we don't, we are going to be able, you know, to put all those data, to take from the shelf some algorithms, and then, you know, just run them against the data that we have. And that's it. And we are going to do that, you know, 10, 20 times for, at the end, choosing only one model that we created, you know, with those data. So the AI part, you know, is, for instance, very bad at understanding that the kind of impact that it has. But I was talking about, you know, planes and cars and I mean, all those industries, they all have, you know, their play there. And they are all, you know, doing the stuff because they can, you know, and without realizing what is the impact. But of course, there is regulation that is coming. Because, you know, some people are saying, you know, I mean, it's bad. You are doing, you know, you are creating too much CO2, blah, blah, blah. So in particular, in the car industry, we have been mandated both, you know, in Europe and in California, and maybe, you know, in the other places, you know, in the States, we have been mandated by 2035, 2040, you know, to have only electric cars. So it's great because it means that, you know, it will be less CO2 from the non-electric cars, you know, the current engines. But we need also to realize that you know, batteries have also some impact. So we, I guess, the people who are very smart, who made the regulation, you know, did think about the balance there and made the decision that it would be better to have electric cars. But still, we will need some technology in order to be sure that the batteries are not going to impact even more than the thermic engines, right?
Well, several countries and also companies have said that they want to go full bore into EVs. Are EVs better for the environment than fossil fuel cars? I mean, one would think so, right? But perhaps not.
Yeah, I mean, this is the goal. Obviously, you know, as I said, some very smart people thought about it, and I'm hoping that they're right. There is impact. I mean, we cannot say that there won't be any impact, you know, from the electric cars. But the studies that I saw, you know, are showing basically that the impact for the electric cars, they are mainly during their the factory, right? I mean, when they are being built. So this is where the impact is. And then, you know, when they are on the street, obviously they are not producing CO2, so they are much better there. And the impact that they have being built, so mainly, you know, the battery being put together, equals about 6,000 miles of a fossil fuel, you know, car. So it means that after 6,000 miles, you are pretty much, you know, not impacting anymore when your fossil fuel car continues to impact, right? So this is, it depends, of course, on the size and the weight and a lot of different parameters, but you have to keep this thing in mind. So it means that for the first 6,000 miles, you are doing the same kind of impact than an old car would do, an old engine would do. But after that, you are pretty much, you know, doing good for the environment.
That's good to know. I don't think I hear that a lot, you know. Because the narrative today is that EVs are just better for the planet, period. And you don't see they don't hear a lot about the nuance that you just explained.
Yeah, I mean, we need to, in general, you know, the scientists, the people, you know, who are creating the technology, this is another thing that we need to be heard more. I mean, you know, there are shortcuts in the media because, you know, this is easier and, you know, this is more impactful also, you know, in terms of putting things in brain of people that they are talking to. And sometimes it's a little bit too much. So, you know, the fact that AI, for instance, you know, was this magical thing, you know, Hollywood kind of AI thing. Now it's a little bit better because people realize and can understand what it is. It's the same thing for electric cars. You know, we need just to explain and say the truth. And again, the numbers that I gave you, this is something that you have to take with a grain of salt, right? It depends on a lot of parameters, but you have to understand that there is impact. There is nothing that doesn't have any impact.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned AI and Hollywood's version of AI, because you kind of went into that in your first book, you know, and with this very provocative title, there's no such thing as artificial intelligence. Have you changed your view, or do you want to update your view?
No, I didn't change at all. So, I mean, the reality is that the title was about this, you know, media view of AI. Basically, what we were presented, you know, 4 or 5 years ago as this magical thing. So what I tried to make clear in this book was to say, look, this is not Hollywood. This is not science fiction. This is not Robocop. This is not Her, right? So those AIs that can be, you know, lovely like Her, or those AIs that can be scary like Terminator, I mean, they actually don't exist. This is not what AI is, okay? AI is whatever we want it to be, right? So we decide AI is in our hands. I mean, I compare an AI, because there are multiple AIs, by the way. There is not one AI. This is a lot of AIs, right? So this is the first thing that we need to understand. So if I had to give a definition of one AI, it would be one toolbox, right? And inside the AI, you have multiple AIs, plenty of AIs. And each of them, they are going to be very specialized into some tasks, right? And so that's why I always compare one AI to one hammer. I mean, I love the hammer. It's a very good tool. All those AIs, they are very powerful tools. And the hammer is great because it's going to drive the nail in the wall much better than my fist, right? It's going to be perfect for that. But this tool, this very same tool, this very same hammer, I can use it to hit your head. And obviously, you know, it's not good. It's not what it is meant for, but I can use it like that. But who is using it like that? Me, because I have the handle of the hammer in my hand. This is my decision. And this is our decision to use those AIs. And we can use them, you know, the right way, and we can use them the wrong way. But they are just tools that we collectively decide how to use them the right way and how not to use it the right way and to decide to regulate, you know, the way to use them. So AIs are powerful tools, but they are only tools that we build and we use. And this is our fault if it goes into Terminator. So Terminator, you know, is basically something that is going to be, you know, autonomous somehow. And this is where autonomy doesn't exist, actually, because Terminator, I launched it. You know, this is like Frankenstein, right? I launched it. So this is my fault. This is me who decided to put that on the street.
Good point. We don't hear that enough. And of course, the current hype, which is the AI celebrity du jour, is ChatGPT. And, you know, the same hype cycle again. You know, it was the metaverse last year, and now it's ChatGPT. Can you explain to us in realistic terms how we should think about ChatGPT and other generative AI models?
So there's a very good news, actually, in what happened, you know, recently with ChatGPT and all those generative AIs. So first of all, I mean, one of the issues of AI in general is that we shouldn't have called that AI. Okay, so the name intelligence, the word intelligence in artificial intelligence shouldn't have been used, you know, but it was almost 70 years ago, you know, so we cannot change that. So we are still going to use it. But the good news about the generative AI is that they called it the right way this time. So it means that it's called generative AI. So it's not creative AI. And it's a very, very interesting point there because it means that the creativity still lies on my lap. I decide to use this thing. So it means that the creativity is in the prompt. You know that to use ChatGPT of the other generative AIs like DALL-E or Midjourney or whatever, I mean, there is a prompt first. So this is a language model that is going to interpret what I'm going to say, right? So I'm going to say, write a paragraph about the fact that the Earth is flat. Okay, so I create the prompt, okay? And the AI is going to generate something that is going to be, that is influenced by my prompt. And it generates something, and in this case, it's going to generate a paragraph that is going to say that the Earth is flat. And of course, the Earth is not flat, right? So, but it can generate a very good article or paragraph about the fact that the Earth is flat because I asked for it. And because on the internet, somewhere, you know, there are people that believe that the Earth is flat. So they can, you know, generate something like that because it's a remix, basically, of whatever has been taken, you know, from the internet. Because ChatGPT, for instance, we have to understand that it's about 175 billion parameters. It's a huge language model. It's huge. I mean, it's basically almost the full internet, you know, that is there. And we know, I guess that we know for a while now, that there are some things on the internet that are wrong. So you can find, you know, something that is wrong. In this case, you know, finding people that are describing why the Earth is flat. So the creative stays on my side. And those AIs, they are going to generate something that is coming from, you know, the full internet, basically. Okay? So this is what it is about. There is one issue. You know, if I like the name, There is one point that I don't like very much, and that is going to be an issue in the next few months when the bubble is going to burst, you know. So, and one of the issues is an IP issue, because those parameters, 150 billion parameters, it's about, you know, 300 billion words actually that are there. I mean, they are coming from somewhere, and they are coming from people that are actually did create, you know, those things that are out there on the internet. Even though they talked about the fact that the Earth is flat, they still created, you know, the fact that the paragraphs about the flat Earth. So there is a copyright issue there, because, and it's going to be seen more in the AIs that are generating, you know, images, because those images, they are coming from somewhere. So it means that, you know, the inspiration is a little bit too much of inspiration. So people are going to claim that there are some things that they belong, that belong to them, you know, and it's going to be an issue. Because today, when you use a generative AI, it's clear in the EULA, in the end user license agreement, it's very clear that everything that is generated by the AI is yours. This is, you know, what it is about. So it means that you can put your copyright on an image that is generated by Midjourney, for instance. But actually, I mean, what you did create it with the prompt, but the generation is coming from we don't know where. And some people most likely can claim that it's coming from them somehow.
So how useful is ChatGPT? How transformational, I guess I should say, is ChatGPT really? Because right now the hype cycle is just over the top.
Yeah. Right now it's crazy. 100 million people are using it or used it at least once, you know, and it's very interesting. And it's a very interesting tool because it's going to help you to generate some very, very interesting, you know, text or images or whatever that you wouldn't be able to create yourself very easily because, you know, you don't know how to start or something like that. So it's going to help you to start, right? So it's going to give you a direction, but again, thanks to your prompt, thanks to your creation, okay? But now how useful is it going to be? Of course, you know, we saw in the past 2 weeks specifically, you know, that it's very dangerous to use that in a web browser, you know, in the search engine. So, of course, you know, Microsoft was very happy to push that and to say that OpenAI, which is the creator of ChatGPT, did that thanks to the billions that were given, you know, was by Microsoft. So it's very good, and they were very happy to say that they were going to put that in their search engine. But I think that it's a mistake because the accuracy is not good. And unfortunately, because of this push basically by Microsoft, you know, and saying that they were going to put it in Bing, Google, who has this technology, you know, this technology for years. I mean, they have it, you know, much before, you know, way before OpenAI. They actually didn't use it in their search engine because they knew it was going to be a disaster if they do. And guess what? When they did their demonstration of Bard, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it was a disaster because, of course, the thing, you know, didn't say the truth, didn't give the good information about whatever satellite or the lens that is up there, you know, in the sky. So anyway, so it didn't give the right information. So it proved that it was actually, you know, sometimes wrong. And the sometimes is actually big because scientists now, you know, are saying that about 36% of the time, you know, ChatGPT is wrong, which is a lot of time. So if you use that in a search engine, I mean, if you are wrong 36% of the time, it's not going to fly. So, and by the way, this mistake, you know, costed something like $100 billion, you know, dollars to in valuation to Google that day. This is crazy, right? But they knew it. I mean, I don't know why they did it, because they knew this is why they didn't publicly, you know, say that they would use this kind of technology in their own search engine. So it was a big mistake. That said, there are some very, very interesting ways to use this very same technology. And talking about Microsoft still, I think that one very smart ways to use the ChatGPT-like, you know, technology and to use the OpenAI investment that they have, using that, for instance, in Excel, will be a very, very good thing, because in Excel, what am I doing? You know, I'm putting a bunch of numbers, blah, 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 and I'm trying to have some formulas. And, you know, I'm not the king of the formulas. It's kind of difficult, you know, to program, you know, something. But I could very easily ask ChatGPT to do something like, you know, can you add column A and column B and then do the average? A very single prompt like that, simple prompt like that, is going to generate the formula that is not complicated, but that is going to be very well formulated, you know, by generated by ChatGPT. And then this is a very good use, because of course, obviously, this is a very good helper, but very, very narrow, very, very pointed, right? Same thing in Word. In Word, just imagine you are in front of this white, you know, blank page. I mean, and you say, okay, I want to write this article about the flat earth. You know, I really want to, you know, give me some hints, write something about the flat earth. And then it's going to generate a paragraph, you know, about the flat earth. And you are going to edit that and, you know, put your own source and something. So there are plenty of ways that are going to be much more pointed, much more, you know, focused, and that are going to be very interesting. But in a search engine, it would be a big, big mistake, I think.
So just to drill down a little bit into what you just said. So how is having, you know, inaccurate facts in a search engine different from having inaccurate facts in ChatGPT when you ask it to generate like a piece of content, like write an essay? What's the difference? I mean, if both have errors, why is a search engine worse?
The thing is that, you know, you can generate everything you want. So because you are going to define the prompt. So you can lead and mislead the thing, you know, the way you want. So, and in the mislead part, it can be wrong. So it can be right, you know? So the thing is that the reality is that we need to understand, first of all, we need to educate ourselves about the fact that this thing is kind of a toy if we use it as a generic thing, because it can say, you know, bullshit. And frankly, this is what it is, right? I mean, today you can tell ChatGPT, I mean, oh, 2 + 2 = 5. And ChatGPT will say, you know, very confidently, yes, you know, 2 + 2 = 5, and it's great, you know, you're right. You know, you really, you know, put whatever idea and creativity in this thing, and you are going to malax it and change it, because this is by adding prompt over prompt over prompt that you are putting more and more of your idea in this thing, and that you are actually creating, and this thing is just following by using whatever data is coming from anywhere, including wrong facts.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Thanks for explaining that. So shifting gears a little bit, you've worked in top management in some of the largest companies in the world, Apple, Samsung, HP, and now Renault. Can you share with us a little bit what your approach to AI is at Renault?
So, I mean, the approach for me is always the same. I mean, I'm very cautious, first of all, so I'm not, you know, claiming that it's going to solve all the issues. And for instance, in those companies like Samsung or Renault today, I mean, first of all, I mean, where should we use AI? This is the first question, you know, and why? Is it going to be beneficial, you know, for the company, for the people? And where are the places where it could impact the most, not negatively, but positively, right? So, for instance, you know, in the factories, I mean, we have robots, you know, for years, I mean, being at Samsung or at Renault, there are a lot of robots that are spitting a lot of data, but the data is not being used because, you know, it's a lot of data and, you know, we are not very comfortable with it. So there, it's pretty easy to go and to say, okay, look, just, you know, connect all those things, you know, and analyze those data, have the people from the job, you know, that are doing the job, usually knowing what is happening in the factories and so on, you know, comment a little bit of what it means to have this kind of data, and then create a model that is going to help maybe to know when the specific robot is going to be, you know, out. And then, you know, you are going to do some what we call predictive maintenance or predictive, you know, preventive maintenance. So this is something that is very, that looks very simple. It's actually pretty simple maths, you know, but this is what AI is about, you know, is maths. So this is the kind of thing where you are going to see, you know, when you are going to look at what a worker is doing, you are going to be able to say, okay, maybe I can reproduce some of these things, and I don't have, you know, to impose him or her to have to do these repetitive tasks, you know, all the time. So you go all over the place, you know, going in for instance, if I take the automotive industry, you go first in the design, where they are going, you know, to create the thing very, very early on. Then you go in the factories and you see what can be done. And then you go in the car itself, outside the car, you know, whatever is the perception to understand what is outside, inside the car to understand how people are going to relate to it. So you are going to find, you know, a bunch of ways to put some AI, since, you know, remember, there are tools. So you are going to find the right tools. Here it's going to hammer, there it's going to be the saw, and you are going to, you know, put those tools in place in order to improve whatever, you know, the product itself, or the way you create the product, the way you build the product.
Yeah, that sounds right. And I have to say that I love that ad campaign you're recently running at Renault, asking fans to create AI-generated images of Twingos. I think it's running through March. So that was a lot of fun to look through. Just going back to what you've said in earlier interviews that you've had with other news outlets, you've said that full autonomous driving, level 5, will never exist. But then I noticed that on Renault's website, it says that the company has conducted a pilot since 2016 of autonomous driving, and it uses advanced driver assistance system as a gateway to that. So do you still hold to that view that autonomous driving will never exist?
Yeah, so we need to give, you know, the definition, actually. So there are different levels in autonomous driving. There are level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? So what I'm claiming is that level 5 will never exist. This is a full autonomy that is going to be from A to B in any circumstances, you know, blah, blah, blah. So this is the part that I'm going to prove it in the next few minutes if you want, but this part will never exist, because it's just impossible. This is perfection, basically, and perfection doesn't exist. So we shouldn't lie. You know, I was talking about lying before. Now, we shouldn't lie about the technology. We should always say, you know, what is possible or not. And in this case, I think that, you know, since 2018, when Elon Musk declared that you know, autonomous driving level 5 was, around the corner, it was a lie. But, you know, we know that this guy, you know, is lying anyway. So let's come back, you know, to what we are claiming at Renault, and we are doing, and most of the car companies are doing, including the new ones, you know, like the Rivian, the Lucid, the Teslas, which are very, very advanced. Okay, so in terms of electronics and AI and software, so we are catching up. We, the old guys, right? The Ford, the Italians, the Germans, the French. So we are catching up by putting more and more software in those cars. ADAS is the first step, as it's written, you know, on a website. And ADAS is the driving heads, basically, right? It's helping to brake better, to see better, to do some of those things better. So, and this is thanks to AI. Right, because there are cameras and there are, you know, lidars, radars. I mean, there are things that are coming in the cars that are helping us. They are helpers. They are assistants. This is what AIs are. They are helping us to do better, a better task, you know, over and over. The claim of autonomous driving in the case of Renault, I don't think it's a claim of autonomous driving level 5. Right? There is no level indicated, because, I mean, is the claim of autonomous driving that is going to be affordable by people? One of the issues also, you know, of AI is affordability of the devices that you have to put in the car. For instance, today, as you might know, in Teslas, there are only cameras, right? There is no lidars, for instance. And some of the very expensive cars like Waymo, for instance, Waymo, even though they are not selling cars, in their cars, they have lidars. Lidars is a kind of radar that sees, you know, basically better than the light, let's say. And so it's a super camera that you would use that is going to help you to see, for instance, you know, with the quotes, when there is fog, which a normal camera doesn't see when there is fog. And that is going to be better than radar that also see in the fog. But LiDARs are very expensive, right? So, I mean, they are about $7,000 today, right? So if you have to put five LiDARs, which is the case, you know, in the Waymo cars today, I mean, it's right there, $35,000, right? So, I mean, we need to be careful not to also put technology just for the sake of technology, right? And to understand what do we want there. We want cars that are going to be safe, right? Today, there are 1 million deaths on the road every year, right, over the world. So we could, by going to level 3, because today, I mean, no one is at level 3 yet, right? So by going to level 3 and maybe going to level 4, we will already eradicate about 90% of those accidents. We shouldn't say that there won't be any accidents because it would be a lie. There still will be accidents, but it will be, you know, 900,000 people that we save every year, which is huge. So let's be a little bit modest, you know, and try to do something that is going to be possible. Level 3 first, that is going to be super ADAS, basically, and then level 4, that is going to look like autonomous, you know, most of the time. But the key there is that most of the time. So it means that sometimes it won't. And this is what level 5 cannot be, because there will be always a case somewhere where the car cannot handle it. And there will have to be a human intervention, be it inside the cockpit or be it remotely. But we will need a human intervention, because there will be cases that the cars will never, I mean, they would never have seen it before. And so they would have to have some help somehow. So this is why level 5 cannot exist, because level 5 implies that it can handle every situation. Us humans, sometimes we are confronted to situations that we never saw before. It happens. It's rare. It's very rare, but it happens. What do? We invent. And you know what? We create something. And again, I come back to this creativity thing, is that the AI cannot create, cannot invent. If it didn't see the case before or a similar case, it cannot do anything about it, right? So this is the issue of thinking that AIs can be generalist, you know, what we call the AGI, the artificial general intelligence. This is us, and this is not possible, because us, when we don't know, we invent, and there are a lot of things, you know, that we invent during the course of our lives. So, so AGI is impossible, and autonomous driving level 5 is a kind of AGI, because it can handle everything.
Well, can generative AI make a difference and put us closer to level 5?
Generative AI can, remember, it can generate. So it's going to generate based on the things that it saw before, right? So if there is a case that it didn't see, I mean, generative AI can give an opinion of what, you know, it can do according to what it saw before, but not about the specific case. So again, generative AI can be very interesting, but I doubt that in this particular case, you know, it can do anything about it. Let me give you an example of a case that is a real case that level 5 cannot handle, you know. It's a case that is, of course, very rare, but it happened one day. And actually one day, one car, you know, was actually mystified by it. And what is it? It's a case of what happened here in the Silicon Valley, it was in 2020 or whatever. There was a Waymo car driving in the street of Mountain View, and it happened that, you know, this car, it was in autonomous mode, and every meter it was stopping for no apparent reason. Right, it was stopping every meter. And people behind the car, of course, you know, were honking because it didn't make any sense. And then when you look at the video, because there is a video of this car, you see that there are two people walking on the sidewalk, right? And one of the two people walking on the sidewalk, on his shoulder, he has a stop sign. Of course, when you a human being, you see a guy on the sidewalk walking with a stop sign in the same direction that you are, you don't care. You just drive. The autonomous car saw a stop sign and a stop sign and a stop sign, you know? I mean, it was something that they cannot handle, you know, because it never saw that before. So before something like that, and what it saw is a stop sign, so it made the right decision. It followed the rules.
So I'm glad you mentioned Waymo and also Cruise, because, you know, they've been making announcements that they're deploying these robotaxis in different cities. So that's not level 5, right? That's level 4?
So they are about level 4, but they can be level 5 in very controlled environment. So also, you know, there is something that we need. So when we talk about level 5, generic level 5, it's any environment. You put the car in India, you could put the car, you know, in Italy, you could put the car anywhere, it's going to work, right? So when they announced the thing, and I drove myself, you know, some robot taxis in Phoenix, Arizona, some Waymos, and it's working very well. I mean, it's very impressive, you know, it goes pretty fast, it's very reliable. Sometimes, you know, it's jerking a little bit, it's weird. But I mean, overall, it's very, very good, right? But, you know, Phoenix, if you know Phoenix, Arizona, I mean, you know, the roads are pretty straight, it's the environment is pretty cool, I mean, it's flat. I mean, you know, it's not an environment that is going to change. I mean, of course, you know, snow, you still have to talk about it because it won't happen. Fog doesn't happen that much. So, you know, the environment is good. You know? So, yeah, you can claim that it's almost 5 there. You know, but it's 5 in an environment that is specific, so it means that it's not really 5. Right, and same thing in San Francisco, because they did and Cruise actually is operating in San Francisco. We heard a lot of issues, right? I mean, there are a lot of articles that are talking about you know, jamming some streets because it doesn't know how to handle a fire truck or stuff like that. I mean, you know, there are issues, but it's learning, so it's going to be better and better. But it's definitely not 5. Right? It doesn't handle the situation like I do. Right? There are some videos that are hilarious, actually, about some cruise cars or Waymo cars as robotaxis, you know, in San Francisco, where the car, you know, goes into a work zone, you know, and it's totally stuck because the workers are in front of it and the thing doesn't know how to handle it. So, I mean, you know, the reality is that somehow you need to have a plan B for those cars. And the plan B, again, doesn't have to be inside the cockpit, so it means that you don't have to put a wheel there. The plan B could be very well be something, you know, that is remote, and that a guy remotely will be able to take, you know, control of the car and get it out of the situation in which, you know, it is, which is not normal. And we can imagine this guy, you know, being remote, having the ability to control, you know, thousands of cars, because the time that it happens when there is a specific issue are going to be, you know, a very small percentage. So this guy can be, you know, in front of screens with 1,000 cars that, you know, he waits until, you know, it has an issue. And that's it. So, but again, 5 is too complicated. And by the way, I mean, it would be way too expensive to have those cars. I mean, those cars are going to be, you know, $200,000, $300,000. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So we need to be very, very careful also on that, because real people cannot buy this kind of thing.
So for level 3 and 4, do you still need a driver? Or are there instances when the driver can be, you know, kind of disengaged?
Yeah. So 3, you will most likely need a driver still on some very specific situation, like on freeways, you know, when they're well marked, blah, blah, blah. So you can actually take off your hands from the wheel. But I mean, it would be better to have the driver not far, right? So the remote thing that I was talking about, what happened. Level 4, yeah, there will be plenty of situation when you will be basically, you know, you can turn the seat and play with the kids and whatever. So it would be more, you know, like most of the time autonomous, as I said.
Thank you for your answer. That really clears up quite a bit. So one of the things that that you're pretty famous for is around the development of Siri. Can you tell us, you know, way back then, you know, what your role was, how Siri came about, how you developed it, co-developed it? Just bring us back to those exciting days.
Yeah, so it was really way, way, way back there, right? So, I mean, it was a Siri before it was Siri, right? So it means that Siri was released to the public at Apple in 2011. It was built as a company in 2007, but the idea and the very first patents were built in 1997. Okay, so it was back there. It was at Stanford Research Institute, SRI, in Menlo Park. And the idea wasn't what Siri was at the end, right? But the idea was really to have an assistant. Again, you know, I'm talking about assistant all the time because at the end of the day, Siri is just another AI. It's an assistant that is going to help us to do something. At the time, the very first idea, I mean, if you go back to 1997, this is the very beginning of the internet, right? I mean, internet came out, you know, about 1994, 95. So at the time with Adam Chayer, who was the guy, you know, with whom we did the very first patent, with Adam, we had the idea that we had the idea with Adam to create this assistant that was going to help us to navigate this internet that was coming along, right? So we had the very clear vision that the internet was going to be huge. It was going to be big. It was going to be too big. And so we are going to have to have some help to navigate this internet. And so we created this little, it was at the time, you know, a little guy on the side of the browser that was helping us basically to find stuff on the internet. And we were able to naturally, you know, tell him what we wanted, and he was helping us, you know, to navigate. This is before Google. I mean, we are in 1997, right? So there is no search engine. So it was basically our version of the search engine where we were integrating Siri. At the time, the name was the assistant. So we were integrating, you know, the assistant in order to help us to navigate this huge database that was becoming, you know, the internet. So it was the very first instance of it. And it was, of course, you know, using speech, because for us, the most natural way to interrogate and to interact with this assistant, you know, was voice. So it was, the goal was to say, you know, I mean, tell me where all the hotels in San Francisco with a pool, right? So this kind of queries, but it was queries that today you would type, you know, on in the Google search engine. But it was before that, and it was the way it was born, and then it evolved, you know, in the past, in the next 14 years to land on the iPhones.
Are you surprised how good digital assistants are today, and the great strides that NLP has come since then?
Yeah, so it's a big change, of course, you know, on the 14 years actually that went from the creation of the assistant to the release of Siri. There was already a lot of very interesting things that happened, but it was all based on pretty old technology that was back, you know, the technologies of the 90s. Then, you know, it was released in 2011, and then came something new, you know, something that we will call today in AI. There is the neural networks. In the neural networks, there is what we call machine learning, basically. And then there is deep learning. And deep learning really, you know, appeared about 2013, 2014. And this is when, you know, some new agents, some new assistants came on board, namely, you know, Google Assistant and Alexa. Right, and she's here around, so she's listening to me. But that's fine. So, and both of them, they were then using, you know, the new technologies. So they use the deep learning thing, so based more on statistics, you know, of what can be said. So not exactly the old technologies that we were using in Siri. So Siri kind of lost a little bit ground, you know, in the early 2010, I mean, 2014, 15. And so natural language became, you know, even more interesting because it was all mixed up, basically, between the voice recognition and the natural language understanding. And the big advances were really in those, you know, 2014, 2016 years, where we had those Google Home and Alexas, you know, working with the people. And people were able to ask questions that were much more complicated, you know, and some references to references, you know, what was the age of Napoleon's mother when he was born? So this kind of complex queries were possible, you know, to ask with the new natural language, because it was based on the big data, on the fact that somewhere, somehow, somebody, you know, asked already this question. And this is something that made sense.
If you could project out maybe 5 to 10 years from now, what's the potential of these digital assistants? What could they do in the future that they cannot do today?
So today, the digital assistant, I mean, they don't have really, you know, conversational capabilities, right? With something like ChatGPT, they could say a lot of bullshit, but they could have more conversation, you know, because this is what a chat is about. So I think that we are going to see that, you know, and maybe we'll be able to control that a little bit. I think that the regulator will force us to control that a little bit. But anyway, so I think that we are going to see a little bit more conversational agents, you know, in the next few years. But we shouldn't do that to do that. So we need to have assistants, you know, doing something. So we need to have those agents, those AIs doing something. And I think that in a lot of different domains, we are going to see even more precise and more interesting and more focused tools, because again, they are only tools, you know, that are going to do something very incredible in the areas they are going to tackle. So, of course, there are three areas that I think are going to be incredible just to, you know, help humanity, basically. Of course, in medicine, right? I mean, in medicine, we are going to see a lot of advances, you know, we saw already some very interesting AIs that are able to find in radios some cancer and stuff like that. We are going to see, you know, how to interpret the DNA. I mean, everything that is statistical basically is going to be very interesting in medicine because, I mean, AIs are statistical. So big advances there. The assistants are going to assist more and more the people. And again, they are going to assist the doctors. They are not going to replace them, but they are going to help them to be better at their tasks. We are going to see a lot of progress also in transportation. We talked about it a little bit, you know. So, you know, the population is getting older and older in all the countries. So we are going to have to most likely, you know, help people that have reduced mobility, you know, to be mobile thanks to those technologies. So most likely we'll see some very interesting advances in transportation as also. And then we are going to see also something in education, because we need to educate ourselves about all those things. It goes fast. And all those technologies, you know, you said it yesterday, it was metaverse. You know, today it's generative AI. Tomorrow it would be quantum. I don't know, right? So it goes very fast. So we need to educate ourselves. And we are going to need those agents, you know, those little, you know, guys on our shoulders that are going to help us to be aware of what is happening, and hopefully they won't say, you know, a lot of crap, and they will help us to keep within the truth, because this is one of the issues of those agents potentially, is that they could actually, you know, deviate and go somewhere we don't want them to go.
One of the biggest problems with AI is the black box issue. That is, you don't know how the AI model comes to its conclusion. Is there a solution to this?
Yeah. So first of all, I don't think that it's a black box. So it's a black box to the people who want them to be a black box. So of course, you know, you have to moderate a little bit. So I still believe that the people that are creating the AI, they're pretty much where they are going. Okay. So for those guys, this is not a black box. And if they're pretty much where it's going, they should be able to explain what they are doing and which data they are using, which algorithms they are using. Of course, you know, data and algorithms, I mean, they can be wrong, right? I mean, as we said, I mean, we can always choose the wrong thing, but we can explain it. So it means that those guys, they can explain. It means that we can educate ourselves, you know, with those guys. It doesn't mean that we all have to be data scientists or, you know, AI specialists or something, but we can at least educate ourselves and listen to those guys in order to understand where it's going and to have a sense of what it is. So the black box shouldn't really be black. You know, the black box should be kind of, you know, shaded transparent, right? Until, you know, it becomes totally transparent, because we can really explain everything. And maybe some AIs are going to help us to explain the AIs, right? Because it goes fast, because it does, you know, billions or millions of calculations, you know, every second. So, I mean, of course, it's complicated, but I think it's potentially explainable.
Wonderful, wonderful answer. So I know you said earlier that you don't believe we'll ever get to AGI, artificial general intelligence, because that's what we humans are, right? Do you think once quantum computing gets developed and becomes real and practical, that your view will change, that we would get AGI at some point, and level 5?
Yeah, so I don't think that my view will change. I will explain later. But I mean, for sure, I think that quantum computing is going to be a very, very interesting development, right? So let me do some very, very basic comparison, you know, between the current AI and the quantum AI. So the current AI, it's based on mathematics, right? It's logic and statistics. And mathematics is something that is coming out of our brain. We created mathematics, right? So we decided to try to model, have a model of the world, you know, with mathematics somehow, right? And there are some things that we cannot still explain using mathematics. But I mean, this is what you try. So mathematics, this is coming out of us. Physics, this is us. Biology basically is physics, right? So our brain is a piece of physics. Now, people that are looking at brain and that are trained to explain the brain and to explain how it's working and so on, neuroscientists, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, they are saying today, I'm not because I don't understand anything, but they are saying today that we know about 20 to 40% of what is happening up there, right? So we are still very far to understand what is happening. But that said, this thing up there, this is physics. So quantum is physics. Right, it's based on physics instead of being based like today on mathematics. So it means that one day maybe we'll be able to model, you know, in a better way, you know, the brain. And so if we model that, I mean, maybe we'll have something that will look much more like that. But remember, we know only between 20 and 40%. So, you know, I mean, if we model only 20 to 40%, we are still far. But one day, maybe we'll know, you know, 90% and maybe 100%. So let's imagine that we know 100% of the brain and we can model it, you know, with a quantum computer that has a lot of neurons because there are a lot of neurons there. We have to understand that today, the qubits that are part of the quantum computers, you know, the biggest quantum computer today has maybe, you know, a few hundred qubits, right? It's very, very limited still. So, but anyway, so we can imagine that. Very good. So now we have something that models the brain exactly. We are good. And so we say, okay, I have it. There is one little issue there. So I still believe that somewhere there are some things that we cannot understand in ourselves. So, you know, that there was a battle about 200 years ago, 300 years ago, between the philosopher in Europe, right? So the philosopher, French, German, I mean, all those guys were very smart. They were fighting and they were writing, you know, the encyclopedia at the time. And it was a great time, you know? And all the philosophers, they were at the same time mathematicians and they were physicists and they were, you know, and all those guys, they were really scientists, right? They were incredible. And at the end of the big discussion, you know, after 100 years of, you know, fighting, they decided one thing. They decided that there is not only something that you can learn, but there is also something that you don't know what it is. And, you know, maybe there is God in the thing. So for people who believe in God, maybe there is God. Maybe there is something else. I don't know. Me as a scientist, and as I'm not a believer in God, but I believe that there is something that I cannot explain. And so this thing that I cannot explain, I can even put some words on it. Right? If I cannot put words on it, I cannot put parameters on it. So I cannot program it. I cannot, even though, you know, I have this brain that is incredible, that is quantum brain. I mean, there are some things, I don't know what it is. And so one thing, for instance, you know, what is empathy? I don't know. It depends. It depends on people. I have a word, but I don't even know exactly what the words mean, what the word means, right? So it depends on other things. What is love? What is friendship? What are all those feelings after all, right? So those feelings, I am going to have a lot of issues to program them and to make, you know, thing working with that. So this is the difference between what I can learn and what I cannot learn. So the culture, you know, people that are born in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, somehow, somewhere, even though they are the same human beings, right? There is something that we cannot explain that made them different, you know? And I believe in human, in the fact that everybody is the same and can do the same. I believe that they all have the same chance, but that's not the truth. So there is something that made them different and that, you know, this is this undefined thing that you cannot learn.
When we will leave it at that, what a wonderful last word. Thank you so much, Luke Giulia, for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Deborah. Thank you very much.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.